Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Wednesday, June 1st, 2016. Yesterday, Donald Trump gave us a preview of his Dictator Act. Our opening music today is a classic from the Pet Shop Boys. It's called The Dictator Decides.
The joke is I'm not even a demagogue. Have you heard me giving a speech? My facts are invented. I sound quite demented. So deluded, it beggars belief. It would be such a relief not to give another speech.
Donald Trump, truly demented, makes up his own facts, and I've got examples for you right here. And let me say that I have been trying to be very choosy about exactly what I report about Donald Trump, because I don't like to give attention to an idiot, to a demagogue, to somebody who is just willing to say anything in order to get media coverage. But at a certain point, I have to recognize that he could become the next president of the United States. And yesterday, at the Trump Towers in New York, he called a press conference and he excoriated the media, saying that the media lies and political reporters are the absolute worst. And we'll get to his personal attacks in a moment. But what troubled the Donald is that he was prodded by the Washington Post to make good on a pledge that he offered up this past February, when he ducked one of the Iowa debates saying, oh, I'd rather go raise money for veterans. Well, he claimed that he had raised $6 million. But until the Washington Post about 2 weeks ago started to ask questions, hey, where's the money? Who did it go to? Did you actually raise $6 million? Well, that's when Trump finally got into action, because it was a couple of days later that a flurry of veterans-related organizations started to receive checks from the Trump Foundation. Most of the checks that the Associated Press was able to track down were dated on May 24th, the day the Washington Post published a story questioning whether he had distributed all of the money. And let's just review what he said and whether it was true or not. Trump said he'd raised $6 million for veterans. It wasn't true. He later claimed that he never used the $6 million figure, but that wasn't true. His campaign insisted Trump had contributed $1 million himself, but that wasn't true until last week. Trump said he didn't want to have credit for the fundraising efforts, but that really isn't true. And he said he and his team were vetting groups that they've never heard of 4 months after the fact, but that wasn't really true either. Nevertheless, the best defense is a strong offense, and that's the Trump playbook. So he went on the offensive against the media, always a great punching bag, particularly for somebody who is appealing to right-wing, low-information voters, the people who don't read newspapers because, well, well, we'll let them fill in those blanks. But it got very personal. And this is what I found deeply disturbing, and I don't usually talk about my dreams, but it crept into my dreams last night, and I was really angry at Trump for this dictatorial posture, and assuming that he can just talk down to reporters who are doing their job in an honorable way. And I've got my own issues with the Beltway media and the political pundits and the way they play Trump for their own gain. But in this episode, the reporters were simply scrutinizing a pledge that he had made and trying to make sure that he had followed up. And Trump really responded. What got under his skin is that he considered this bad publicity. Instead of being like, thank you very much, Mr. Trump, or Trump did a good job, everyone's saying, who got it, who got it, who got it? And you make me look very bad. I have never received such bad publicity for doing such a good job. Well, this shows how important his public image and the PR machinery is to Donald Trump. The image, the optics, that's what's more important than any manner of substance. And so when he started attacking individual reporters, he singled out a guy from ABC and called him a sleaze. Another guy asked, is this the way you're going to be as president? Trump said yes, and then he pointed at the man who had asked that question and said, I've seen you on TV. You're a real beauty. So he really personalized this in ways that really, predict a really ugly process through the election. And if Trump becomes president, the kind of discourse, such as it is, that we can expect from this man is at a new and very low level. Now, here are a couple of other comments that I feel compelled to report on. Trump was in California last Friday, and he met with 50 farmers in the Central Valley. They complained to him about the water shortage that's caused by a natural event called a drought. And the farmers claim that environmental regulations and court decisions favor fish over farms, and they'll let the salmon and the other fish die in the interests of growing crops that, of course, can be revived once the water flow is restored by Mother Nature. But Trump, after meeting with those farmers, and these are, you know, the big corporate farmers, the factory farms, and the water districts that control water for agriculture that is highly subsidized. I mean, these guys get such a break. They don't even meter the water that they ship to farms, so we don't know how much they're using. But after meeting with those people who have a specific bias, Trump announced there is no drought. And then the, condescending, paternalistic dictator said, "We're going to solve your water problem. You have a water problem that is so insane. It's so ridiculous, where they're taking the water and shoving it out to sea." Now, what he's referring to there is simple ignorance on his part of how the water system in California works. It's very complicated. We have a big river system in the Sacramento River Delta in the northern part of the state, and we already ship a fair amount of that water to Southern California, which is essentially a desert, where they have imported water from the Colorado River and from the Sacramento River in order to make life and crops viable. But he is, you know, really just exposing how simple-minded and ignorant he is. And he follows in the big footsteps, the big muddy footsteps of Carly Fiorina, who tried to use the same issue when she ran for the Senate here in California in 2010. And Sean Hannity, he's done it too. He did a remote broadcast standing above a hill on Fresno and pointing at the parched valley and blaming courts and Congress for the drought, which has been a real factor in California for over 3 years now. Turning now to reaction to Hillary Clinton's email problems, I have a spate of articles here, and I am struck by how serious many observers take this issue, much more so, of course, than the Clinton campaign and its acolytes. But in an article that was first posted at the Huffington Post on Sunday, this past Sunday afternoon, May 29th at 1 in the afternoon, it was gone when I went looking for it several hours later. But, of course, things never disappear from the internets, and if you go to one of the archive sites, you can find the article. It was written by a man I don't know, Frank Huguenard, who's described as a scientist, filmmaker, and speaker. And I want to note that it has absolutely no sourcing. It doesn't say how Mr. Huguenard came by the information that he asserts in this article. But the headline reads, "Hillary Clinton to be indicted on federal racketeering charges." And the writer goes on to detail the RICO Act, the Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act, and what it takes to trigger it. And he asserts that the Clinton Foundation is essentially a criminal enterprise. Less than 10% of the donations to the foundations have actually been released to charitable organizations. I do not know this to be true. I am reporting what I'm reading here. I think the Clinton Foundation has spent much more than a couple of million dollars, but this is the argument that is presented here. And he goes on to say there's ample evidence already in the public record that the Clinton Foundation qualifies as a criminal enterprise, and there's no doubt the FBI is privy to much more evidence that than we have seen publicly. Here's the bio. Frank Huguenard holds a degree in science from Purdue, spent decades in product development in Silicon Valley. So I don't know him or his sources here, But it is interesting that it was allowed to be published, and it's possible, you know, that he's able to publish on his own blog page at the Huffington Post, and then an editor found it and pulled it down. But I think that was an interesting premature ejaculation, if that's what it turns out to be. Meanwhile, a little more substantial and substantive is Peter Van Buren's comments. Now, if you recall, Peter Van Buren's been a guest on this podcast many times. He's a humorous, smart man who spent almost 20 years working at the State Department before he was pushed out by Hillary Clinton for publishing a book called We Meant Well. And he's not, in my view, grinding an axe to get even with Hillary Clinton. But he read the Inspector General's report, and he noted that neither Clinton nor any of her senior staff participated, that she never sought approval, legal or technical, for her unprecedented private email system, that she was warned against it. The report says that the State Department would not have granted approval if she had asked for it. And he makes another a bunch of other important points. And then under the heading Why It Matters, he says Hillary Clinton lied when she claimed her actions were approved. She lied when she said there were no regulations in place at the time of her server decisions. She lied when she said she broke no laws. She lied when she said this was all a Republican hit job. And she lied when she said she would cooperate with any investigation. And in his final line in this post, Peter Van Buren writes, bonus, if Bernie Sanders will not discuss any of this publicly, he does not want to be president. And we're going to revisit that point in a couple of minutes here. Now, there's another piece by a very interesting man, Dan Metcalf. He spent 25 years working at the Department of Justice, and during the 90s, he was fending off investigations into the Clintons. He now teaches at American University in Washington, D.C., at their College of Law, and he posted a piece, Hillary Clinton's emails now might finally take her down. And let me be clear at the outset that he suggests later in his article, not that Bernie Sanders become the nominee if Hillary is disabled, disqualified, or too busy with her lawyers, but he wants a substitute ticket of Joe Biden and John Kerry. Or maybe Kerry and Biden. I certainly don't go along with that. But I think his piece is very powerful. I've linked to it so you can read his commentary at lawnews.com. And he points out, for those of us who recognize from the outset that Ms. Clinton's exclusive use of a personal email system was a clear violation of the Federal Records Act, the findings of the Inspector General were no surprise. And he said he underscores an important point. There are no actual penalties in the Federal Records Act or the Freedom of Information Act. And that's a point that Jason Leopold, the FOIA terrorist, has brought up many times. And he goes on to say here, Metcalf, no, her self-serving email setup was not allowed under the State Department's rules. No, she was not permitted to use a personal system as she did. No, what she did was hardly just a matter of personal convenience. No, there's no evidence that any State Department attorney gave her legal approval. No, everything that she did was not fully above board. And yes, she was indeed required by the Federal Records Act to maintain all official emails in an official system for proper review, delineation, and retention. So I find this interesting, and as I said, I'll link to it, and you can read it for yourself. The thing that kind of goes out of bounds of reality, in my view, is when he praises FBI Director James Comey, who is this straight shooter, an exceptional man of utmost integrity, who can be counted on to recommend a criminal prosecution when the facts and law of a case warrant it. Well, Jim Comey's been running the FBI for a couple of years now, and he, of course, is part of the whistleblower crackdown, and we haven't seen him move to investigate or indict any Wall Street criminals, any white-collar criminals of any description. So I'm not so sure that we're going to see that kind of action from too tall Jim Comey. There's another defector, Doug Schoen, S-C-H-O-E-N. He was the in-house pollster for the Bill Clinton administration for most of the 1990s. And in an article at the Wall Street Journal that I can't link to because it's behind their paywall, he explores the possibilities that Hillary will not be the nominee at the convention in July. So it is fascinating to me to see a range of people who are surfacing on this, you know, issue that I've been talking about for a long time. I think it's very critical. I think that we could wind up with a candidate who gets indicted or at least drawn into serious legal proceedings before the convention, after the convention, or even after the election. And it stuns me that so many Democrats are willing to run a candidate with these serious liabilities. It is just a major head-scratcher. Now, there are two pieces that came across my computer today that I consider to be amusing hindsight. The first is from Chris Saliza, who writes a sometimes snarky column for The Washington Post. And I find myself mostly agreeing with Saliza today. His headline reads, "Bernie Sanders keeps repeating his biggest mistake of the campaign." And he recites that on Meet the Press this past weekend, once again, Bernie Sanders was asked, "Do you think Hillary Clinton needs a clean bill of health from the FBI before she accepts the nomination?" And Bernie Sanders affirmatively dodged the question. And Saliza notes that the only way Clinton loses a Democratic nomination to fight to Sanders is if the race is deeply destabilized to the point where people who felt like Clinton's nomination was close to a foregone conclusion were forced to fundamentally reevaluate that view. And Saliza notes that after Iowa and New Hampshire, Sanders should have started to incorporate Clinton's email troubles into his stump speech, using the ongoing investigation to raise questions in voters' minds about both her trustworthiness and her electability. And I fully agree with Saliza on the political level. This was a huge mistake by Bernie Sanders. I'm sorry, a huge mistake, that's a Y, not an H, to pass on this issue. And there are others that he should have pursued that I believe are fair game as well. So Saliza toward the end says, "It was all right there for the taking. Any underdog candidate looking for a foothold into a race against a heavy favorite would seize on the email controversy in seconds." Well, Martin O'Malley didn't when he was still in the campaign. He goes on to close here by saying Sanders won the battle by ignoring Clinton's emails. No matter what happens in California a week from today, he will have lost the broader war, and he only has himself to blame for it. Now, there's also second-guessing on the Clinton side. And this is a rambling post from a guy named Gene Lyons, who blogs at the National Memo, promising to be smart, sharp, funny, and fearless. And it takes him a while to get to his point here, but he believes that the high-minded Clinton campaign refused to expose Senator Sanders for his communist and socialist baggage, some of the all the stuff we've heard about, you know, that he wrote a fiction piece where he was imagining that rape was okay. All of this stuff is ancient history. And they dig it up to try to say that the Clinton campaign should have mined it more effectively. But what the writer here, Gene Lyons, overlooks is the way the Clinton campaign masterfully used surrogates to raise questions about Sanders' competence, the New York Daily News attacks about that editorial board meeting where it was claimed that he fumbled about how to break up the banks. And there was one attack after another that raised questions about his viability as a candidate and tried to attack him. If you recall, at one point I referred to it as swift boating. And yet I guess Gene Lyons wasn't in the loop for some of those gratuitous attacks. Every day I like to take a moment to thank the people who support my work at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. People like Judy Holloway, Craig Balog, Carl Hesterberg, and George Mashke, who just took out a new annual subscription. He's now living in Den Haag, The Hague, in the Netherlands. And George, I want to not only thank you for your annual subscription, but also let you know that we have taken your advice and we have just upgraded our website to HTTPS. And that is a more secure platform that gives an extra layer of security to our users because what it does is guarantee that my server is the actual server that you're looking for and not some sort of a substitute that could have been set up by a hacker or by a nefarious actor like the NSA. So, George, thank you for that suggestion. Thanks to our webmaster, John Gorenfeld, for implementing it so quickly. And I'm grateful to all of you who participate in this community at peterbcollins.com. And as you know, we're building a new independent media outlet called NewsBud, and I want to thank the people who have kicked in contributions to our Kickstarter campaign. We're just shy of $105,000 today. That means $45,000 to go to reach our first phase goal of $150,000. And tomorrow, Thursday, I'm going to be recording my video on-camera performance, such as it is, for our very first NewsBud report. And once it gets edited, and if everything goes well, you should be seeing it online by Sunday or Monday. Check in at newsbud.com and also at boilingfrogspost.com, which initially will be hosting all of the NewsBud content. And by the way, people have asked about what my intentions are. I plan to keep podcasting here at peterbcollins.com while we build the NewsBud platform. And so I'm not going to stop. I may have some interruptions on some very busy days when I'm recording the video for NewsBud. And, for example, tomorrow, I'm not sure how much time I'll have to do a daily news and comment podcast, but we're just going to see what happens. Well, there's a new study out conducted by the Associated Press showing that 90% of voters in the United States lack confidence in our political system, and 40% agree with me that the two-party structure is seriously broken. And this is one of the reasons that I outlined when we made the case a couple of weeks ago that Bernie Sanders, if he is rejected by the Democrats, should consider running as the Green Party nominee this fall. And it appears that there are many voters who want to see a breakup of the duopoly that Democrats and Republicans maintain, even though neither one is truly a majority party. So these are minor parties that pose as majoritarian, and it really does screw up our political system. 53% of voters say that the Democrats' use of superdelegates is a bad idea. Only 17% support the system. 70% of voters say they prefer that primaries and caucuses would be open rather than closed, to party members. And so people are really actively seeing the failures of our political system, and they're hankering for change, and they're being ignored by many establishment politicians. That is very clear. Yesterday, I kind of went a little emotional when I was talking back to former Attorney General Eric Holder, who recently made comments that while Ed Snowden needs to be locked up for a while, that he did a public service in leaking all of those NSA files. Well, I want to thank Professor Juan Cole. You can find his website, juancole.com. He published a piece that was as strong, if not a little stronger, than my comments yesterday. And he said, nobody in the Obama administration still in office has ever said that Snowden did a public service. He certainly did. It's also clear that the NSA has been sharing metadata with local law enforcement, which has been using it to build cases against people without ever seeking a warrant, and then lying to judges about how they knew someone was, for example, in touch with a drug dealer by phone. I've got a story on that coming up here in the stack in just a couple of more minutes. Professor Cole goes on, sharing of illicitly gathered private information among U.S. government agencies is becoming routine. These cases have nothing to do with terrorism. So, says Professor Cole, Holder's sudden appreciation of Snowden is hypocritical. Well, I agree with that, and that's the word I used yesterday. He goes on to say, Mr. Holder is a man of the U.S. justice system and knows exactly how it functions, so he knows very well that Snowden, it's written Holden, that's why I'm stumbling here, will not be allowed to present a whistleblower defense if he is tried in the U.S., and that no judge will be allowed to take his public service into account. So, Holder is lying. The only question is why. Is this an attempt to go on justifying the Obama administration's despicable war on whistleblowers? Or does Holder think Snowden will be stupid to be enticed back with a new set of false promises? So I'll link to this story. I found it at truthdig.com. You can also go to the Professor Cole's website, and he makes a number of good points that underscore that Eric Holder is a hypocrite and a liar. And here's another story that fits those descriptors: hypocrisy and lying. Do you know who Samantha Power is? She is currently the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. She's been a foreign policy advisor to President Obama since he took office. And before that, she was a journalist. In a book that won her a Pulitzer Prize in 2002 called A Problem from Hell, she wrote that Henry Kissinger, former Secretary of State, had bloodied Cambodia and blackened his own reputation with past U.S. policy. Now, in an ironic twist, Samantha Power has agreed to accept from Henry Kissinger himself the American Academy of Berlin's Henry A. Kissinger Prize. The award is given annually to a renowned figure in the field of international diplomacy. I guess he's going to give it to her for her brilliant support of the takedown of Muammar Gaddafi in Libya. And this article from Truthdig quotes Max Blumenthal, who, by the way, will be on the program in the next week or so. Blumenthal wrote, Samantha Power's most notable accomplishments might be her enabling of the most ruthless perpetrators, primarily through her protection of Israel, a serial human rights abuser in the world's only active settler colonial state. In Syria, meanwhile, where one of the greatest atrocities of modern times continues to devour civilian lives, Power's high-profile initiatives have done little more than generate publicity for herself. And in Libya, where Power's demand for military intervention influenced President Obama's decision to authorize force, the U.S. has thrown open the floodgates of chaos, transforming a repressive but functional state into a destabilized battleground for local warlords and jihadists, and it's a launching point for refugees who are dying in record numbers on the Mediterranean this summer. By the way, I added the last part about the refugees. That wasn't in Max Blumenthal's quote. Blumenthal's also an outspoken supporter of boycott, divestment, and sanctions. And a few weeks ago, I tipped you off to a very bad bill that was sliding through the legislature in Sacramento here in California. It's Assembly Bill 2844, and it has been further amended, but it is still a bad bill. I'm linking to the California Legislative Information website. That's the neutral site where the bills that are in process are posted, and when amendments are made, they are reflected. Well, a lot of the worst language has been taken out of this bill. It no longer is called the California Combating the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions of Israel Act of 2016. The Israel part has been replaced by Recognized Sovereign Nations or Peoples. Also, the draconian language that restricted a contractor with any public entity who contracted for more than $10,000 a year, who could be placed on a blacklist compiled by the Attorney General, well, all that $10,000 and that contractor language is gone. So it is now a relatively toothless bill, and it even demands that the Attorney General provide an assessment to the legislature on whether this piece of shit is constitutional. Now, they took out the worst parts, so it actually may be constitutional the way it has been revised. But it still requires, without definitions, the Attorney General shall develop, maintain, and post on the Internet a list of companies that have engaged in discriminatory business practices in furtherance of a boycott of any sovereign nation or peoples recognized by the government of the United States. Now, that includes Israel. But it no longer is specific and limited to Israel, and that actually might pass constitutional muster. But since there is no definition of what a company that engages in discriminatory business practices has to do in order to be placed on this blacklist, it's still a maddeningly vague and bad bill, and even its author declined to vote for it in its current form. So there is a push to call members of the State Assembly. And if you live in California, please do call your member and advise him or her to vote against AB 2844. A bad ruling from a federal appeals court in Richmond, Virginia. A 12-3 decision overturned a lower court ruling that would have required a warrant for police to access information obtained from cell phone towers. The information can include the location of a specific phone and, you know, inferentially, its user. And the lower court had said that a warrant should be required in compliance with the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution. But the Fourth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals said the Fourth Amendment is optional, and they do require police to get a court order. But it's a much lower standard than the warrant, which requires probable cause. So this is another way that police powers are creeping more and more to a police state level here in the United States. Over in Obama's wars in the Middle East, the push is on to recapture Fallujah in Iraq and Raqqa in Syria. And it's going to be a bloody summer. No question about it. Iraqi forces are pressing an offensive to recapture Fallujah. This is a town that the U.S. blew up twice during the occupation. And, of course, we are advising, assisting, and fighting right alongside the Iraqi forces. The other complicating factor is it's Iranian Peshmerga who are the real frontline fighters to retake Fallujah. And if and when they're successful, that will be a further complication for the United States. Meanwhile, in neighboring Syria, 23 people were killed in an airstrike on a town near Idlib. And the Russians say they didn't have any jets in the air, so the default guess is that it was the Syrian military that conducted these airstrikes. They also are being accused of striking two hospitals near Aleppo, killing 50 people and wounding more than 200. So it's pretty gruesome. The peace talks have generally been suspended, and this war will slog on. As most Americans say, whatever. Thanks for listening to my news and comments, my ranting and raving. I welcome your feedback. You can email Peter at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.